The National Archives podcast series, Titanic, The Last Night of a Small Town, presented by Dr. John Welshman.
I was going to start off just by reading you actually a few paragraphs from the book. I was at a literary festival a couple of weeks ago, and we were warned as authors that audiences don't like readings. I think they were concerned about people reading from their book for a whole hour, but I promise you it's only going to be three paragraphs, so I hope you'll bear with me. After undressing and climbing into the top berth, Lawrence Beasley had read for about 25 minutes. During this time, he noticed the increased vibration of the ship and assumed that they were going at a faster speed than at any time since they had left Queenstown. Earlier, when he sat on the sofa undressing, with his bare feet on the floor, the jar of the vibration had come up from the engines below very noticeably. As he sat up in the berth reading, the spring mattress supporting him was vibrating more rapidly than usual. The cradle-like motion was always noticeable as he lay in bed, but that night there was a marked increase. The vibration must have come up almost directly from below. As Beasley read, the quietness of the night was broken only by the muffled sound that came to him through the ventilators, of stewards talking and moving along the corridors. Nearly all the passengers were in their cabins, some asleep in bed, others undressing, and others only just down from the smoking room, and still discussing many things. Then there came what seemed to him nothing more than an extra heave of the engines, and a more than usually obvious dancing motion of the mattress on which he sat. Nothing more than that. No sound of a crash or of anything else. No sense of shock or jar that felt like one large object meeting another. And soon the same thing was repeated with about the same intensity. The thought came to Beasley that they must have still increased the speed further. And so, with no thought of anything serious having happened to the ship, he continued his reading. Still the murmur from the stewards and adjoining cabins, and no other sound. No cry in the night, no alarm given, and no one anxious. There was nothing to make the most timid person afraid. But in a few minutes, Beasley felt the engine slow and stop. The dancing motion and vibration ceased suddenly after being part of the passengers' lives for 4 days. And this was the first hint that anything out of the ordinary had happened. We have all heard a clock suddenly stop ticking in a quiet room, and then have suddenly noticed the clock and the ticking of which we had previously been unaware. So in the same way, the fact was suddenly brought home to all in the ship that the engines had stopped dead. But the stopping of the engines gave them no information. They had to make their own assessments as to why they had stopped. Like a flash, it came to Beasley. We have dropped a propeller blade. When this happens, the engines always race away until they are controlled, and this accounts for the extra heave they gave. It was not a very logical conclusion, for the engines would have continued to heave until they stopped, but it was at the time a plausible hypothesis. Beasley jumped out of bed, slipped a dressing gown over his pyjamas, put on his shoes, and went out of his cabin into the hall near the saloon. Here a steward was leaning against the staircase, waiting until those in the smoking room above had gone to bed, and he could put out the lights. Beasley said, "Why have we stopped?" "I don't know, sir," he replied, "but I don't suppose it is anything much." "Well," Beasley said, "I'm going on deck to see what it is," and started towards the stairs. The steward smiled indulgently at Beasley as he passed and said, "All right, sir, but it's mighty cold up there." Beasley did feel rather absurd for not remaining in the cabin, but it was his first trip across the Atlantic. He had enjoyed every minute of it and was eager to note every new experience, and to stop in the middle of the sea with a propeller dropped seemed sufficient reason to go on deck. And yet the steward, with his fatherly smile, and the fact that no one else was about the passages or going upstairs, made Beasley feel guilty in an inexplicable way. So I can read a lot more, but I'm not going to. I'm going to stop at that point. But I hope that gives you a kind of flavour of what the book is like and what my approach to it has been. And that's really what I'm going to talk about in what remains of my 40 minutes. I'm going to tell you a bit about why I've chosen this as a subtitle, The Last Night of a Small Town. A bit about the 12 people whose stories feature in the book. And also to try to say a bit about some historical issues, that using their accounts as sources have thrown up. I think this was a slide I included originally when I was giving a talk at my daughter's school, Lancaster Girls Grammar School, and I said then, I'm sorry if you've come wanting to hear a bit about Rose and Jack, I'm not going to be able to say much about them. And the girls all sighed. But in a way, I think this does have a serious purpose, because I find it quite helpful to remind myself about what I actually knew about the Titanic when I started writing the book. I mean, growing up in Northern Ireland in the 1960s, I was aware of the Titanic from quite an early age. In fact, driving to my grandparents' house, we used to go through a town called Cumber, County Down, and my mother always told us the story of Thomas Andrews and pointed out the Thomas Andrews Memorial Hall. But I think when I started writing this book about 2.5 years ago, I mean, I'd seen the James Cameron film. I'd seen many years ago the film A Night to Remember, 1958. I'd read Walter Lord's book A Night to Remember quite a long time ago, but in many ways I don't think I could have named any members of the ship's crew or passengers, apart perhaps from Captain Smith. And in a way I find this quite helpful to keep in mind, well, who have I actually written this book for? And I think the answer to that is that I've written it for the sort of ordinary person who perhaps doesn't know a lot more about the Titanic than I did when I started writing about it. But I hope that even for Titanic experts, of whom, of course, I've discovered there are a large number, the book does have something new to say. By taking this narrower focus. The other thing to say about the sort of origins of the book is that in some ways it goes back to the previous book I wrote, which was published about 2 years ago. As you can see here, the book was called Churchill's Children, The Evacuee Experience in Wartime Britain. Really looking at the experience of the evacuees who went from the cities to the countryside, as I'm sure you know, about which I'd written several articles, which I'd been interested in really ever since I was a postgraduate student. And what I did with that book was I focused on the stories of 12 people, a mixture of children and adults. Well, actually in the end there were 13, because one of the readers of the proposal said there's nothing in this book about Scotland, and so I quickly had to find a Scottish evacuee story, which luckily I had several off. I suppose the question is, well, why focus on 12? And actually that was a piece of advice that was given to me by, I had an agent for about 18 months, which was a bit of a sad story because we parted company and we couldn't agree and we fell out. But one of the things he said to me was, he said, well, I think 12 stories is about the number that a reader can keep in their mind. And so I've sort of stuck to that. And so basically, having finished that book, I really enjoyed writing it. And I thought, well, I'd quite like to have another go at this. I'd quite like to find another historical incident that I could approach through the stories of 12 people. And I think I was just sitting in my study one day and I suddenly thought, oh, well, 100th anniversary of the Titanic, that's about 2.5 years away. That seems about right for researching and writing the book. And so I set to work. And actually, one of the funny things that's happened in just in the last few days is the number of people who've said to me, you know, you're really lucky that this book has just come out to time with the 100th anniversary. If I had a pound for everybody who said that to me, I'd be a rich person. Not realizing, of course, that this is the target I set myself 2.5 years ago. So, a bit about this book. One thing I could say a little bit more about is that my interests, I'm a social historian, so I'm really interested in the stories of people. And what always interested me, I know that a lot of people here are interested in the ship and its technical details, but personally, I was always really interested in the stories of those involved. And that, in a way, was always going to be my focus. And one of the things I particularly enjoyed using as a resource was the Encyclopedia Titanica website, which for any of you, I'm sure many of you have used it, but for anybody who hasn't, it's absolutely fascinating. The idea that there's a page on every single member of the crew and passengers, I find it really addictive. And I was constantly, even now, I'm coming across the stories of people who I didn't know. One of the other things was I was always very clear this was going to be a narrative account, a chronological account, and I suppose it might strike you as slightly surprising to know that historians aren't very familiar, I suppose, with working with narratives. I mean, we're much happier actually working with themes. But this really did interest me as a kind of a new challenge, a new kind of intellectual challenge almost for me, could I really construct a narrative that would appeal to the general reader using some of these survivors' accounts? And one of the other implications of that is what I've really tried to do is to build the story from the bottom up, and in a way to resist adding lots of details of my own, to try to reconstruct this disaster through the eyes of those involved. I said I was going to say a bit more about the subtitle, and some of you may know this comes from Walter Lord's book A Night to Remember, published in 1955. And it's really right at the back of the book, actually. It's not terribly prominent, but in the acknowledgements, Lord writes, quote, "This book is really about the last night of a small town. The Titanic was that big and carried that many people. To tell everything that happened is impossible. To piece together every even part of the picture together has required the help of literally hundreds of people." And this always really appealed to me as a kind of a metaphor for the ship, this idea that it was like a town, there were rich and poor, men and women, adults and children. I just thought it was a great metaphor. And even actually coming here on the underground today, I was sort of thinking a bit more about the metaphor and thinking, well, you know, what is a town really? You know, it's got streets, it's got houses, there are corridors in the ship, there are cabins. And I think probably you could play quite a lot more with this metaphor. I was interested to read an article in Newsweek, which I think was written by the famous historian Simon Sharma, and he mentioned the metaphor of the town, and he said, well, actually, the Titanic wasn't really a small town, it was more like a series of villages. I thought, well, yeah, that's quite interesting. You could think of it in terms of a Norwegian village or a Belgian village or whatever. So my cast list, as I call it. I mean, you can have quite a lot of fun with this. It's a bit like choosing your top 20, you know, favorite pop tunes or whatever. But this is my 12. So as you can see, I'm going to come back to these people later on, so I'm not going to say much about them. I've got two people in first class, three in second, three in third, and four crew members, of whom three were on the Titanic and the other one is Arthur Rosten on the Carpathia. And I've chosen these really to provide, as I suppose, as representative a cross-section as I can of those who were on the ship. And there were certain sort of criteria that I had in mind. Partly, I think, what I was trying to do was to try to sort of correct an imbalance in previous accounts. So in a way, I was consciously trying to sort of reorientate this familiar story away from first class towards the experiences of people in second class and third class, away from men towards experiences of women. So my 12 has got an even number of male and female. Away from the experiences of adults towards those of children, which I suppose reflects in a way my sort of research interests. I'm a sort of interested in the history of children, child health, and so forth. Away from the experiences of passengers towards those of crew members. And also to try to correct what I think is a kind of bias in earlier accounts. And I think this is true of Walter Lord's book, where he focuses very much on the experiences of people who are either British or American. And so I was particularly pleased to find the stories of one woman who was traveling from Finland, and another family who were actually travelling from the Lebanon. So we could talk a bit more about my choice of the 12 in the discussion if you like. I suppose another way of thinking about this is, you know, let's say there are, for the sake of argument, roughly 2,200 people on the Titanic. And if you look at the proportions, I mean, roughly about a third of those are crew. There are 800-odd crew members. Quite surprising what a high proportion of the total people on board was comprised of the crew. About a third of them are people in first and second class, and about a third of them are people in third class. So in a way, with my 12, I have sort of roughly tried to keep those sort of proportions in mind. So I'm just going to very quickly go through my 12 in alphabetical order. Lawrence Beasley studied natural sciences at Cambridge. This is a well-known photograph of him when he was working as a science master at Dulwich College in London. Sadly, his wife had died of tuberculosis 2 years earlier, And although he had a young son, he decided to go and visit his brother who was living in Toronto. Often regarded, I think probably correctly, as the most authoritative eyewitness account. Beasley's account, as many of you will know, was published very quickly, only 6 weeks after the sinking in 1912. And this is just a little extract from it, where Beasley writes, quote, "After dinner, Mr. Carter invited all who wished to the saloon, and with the assistance at the piano of a gentleman who sat at the purser's table opposite me, a young Scotch engineer going out to join his brother fruit farming at the foot of the Rockies, he started some 100 passengers singing hymns." And one of the things that I've really had a lot of fun with is trying to identify as many people as possible from the descriptions that Beasley gives. I mean, I think Beasley's account is a very interesting one. He's trained as a scientist, and it's I think it's quite scientific in the degree of detail that he uses. But it's also quite a novelistic account. And one of the things that interested me about Frances Wilson's book about Ismay was that she suggested that Beasley was quite influenced by his own reading. He'd read a lot of adventure stories about the sea by Robert Louis Stevenson, Joseph Conrad. And so it's quite a sort of novelistic account in the way that he describes the sea and the stars and so on. And this is just one little example of this, that we know that the Scottish engineer who played the piano at this church service on the evening of Sunday the 14th of April was a man called Douglas Norman, who worked for the electrical company AEG in Glasgow. And I really enjoyed doing this, trying to work out who these people were, or in some cases trying to sort of correct minor errors in Beasley's account. Just one little quick example of that is that there's a famous account of him on the second class deck looking down at third class, and he describes a Scotsman going around playing the bagpipes. We know that actually that's one case where Beasley's account isn't correct, that it wasn't a Scotsman, it was an Irishman, who was called Eugene Daly. One of the slightly strange things about being a Protestant growing up in Northern Ireland, going to a Protestant grammar school, is you never know anything about Irish history or Irish culture, play rugby and cricket and so on. But I believe that there are Irish bagpipes which are, I won't try and pronounce the name, but they're actually called elbow pipes. And so one of the things I did with Beasley's account was to correct the Scottish bagpiper into the Irish bagpiper, who played the tune Erin's Lament on leaving Queenstown. I thought that was a really nice story. Harold Bride was a fairly young, relatively inexperienced wireless operator. I did have a picture of, I sometimes swap these pictures around. I had one of Harold Bride, but actually I was quite like this copy of Marconi Graham, which is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Harold Bride, growing up in London. There's actually a blue plaque on the home where he grew up in the suburb of Bromley. Bride's account is similar to Beasley's in that it was published very quickly after the disaster. It was reproduced in the New York Times on the 28th of April. It was originally published on the 19th of April, the day after the Carpathia arrived in New York. Again, this is just a little extract from it. Quote, "After that, I never was out of the wireless room, so I don't know what happened among the passengers. I saw nothing of Mrs. Astor or any of them. I just worked wireless. The splutter never died down. I knew it soothed the hurt and felt like a tie to the world of friends and home. How could I then take news queries?" Bride's account is a fascinating one, I think, a very vivid account. Extracts of it are often reproduced. But I'm just really putting up this little section to flag up the point that it's in many ways an unreliable one. This, of course, is Bride on the Carpathia sailing back with the other survivors to New York. And we know that although he claimed that he was simply sending these telegrams on behalf of other survivors, that he was also negotiating to sell his story to the New York Times, because the telegrams have survived. And he succeeded in doing that for the rather large sum of $1,000. So when the Carpathia docked in New York, he was immediately whisked away by the New York Times, and a reporter took down his story. This is quite a nice photograph, I think, of Edith Brown, obviously in later life. She was only 15. She'd grown up in South Africa, and she was travelling with her parents. who are planning to start a new life in Seattle in the hotel business. I don't think this was, I'm interested in my history of migration, but I think this was a coincidence actually that of my 12 stories, five of them are people who are migrating to new lives in North America. And I do find this fascinating, the idea of people leaving everything behind, starting off with a new life. Some of them, sadly, in many of these families, without giving away the story too much, often the mother and the children survived and the husband or father died. But some of them carried on and continued living in North America. In the case of Edith Bryan and many of the others, because of their tragic loss, they decided they wouldn't carry on and they subsequently went home. Edith Bryan's story, I'm not going to try to read this because it's quite long, but I'll say a little bit about it. It's very different to Beazley and Bride. Most obviously, it was published by her son David Haseman in 2009. And what interests me as a historian is the other issues that this throws up as a source. Most obviously, the issue of memory. Many of these recent accounts, they've sort of added to the archive, but you know from reading them that they're influenced by a number of other things. Often by accounts that have been published previously, particularly the Beazley story. So you get these iconic moments like the Titanic sinking, which are reproduced in the later accounts. Influenced by the evidence that are given at the American and British inquiries. Influenced by the 1958 film and perhaps even the James Cameron film. And of course, the people writing these accounts, who are often family members or friends, bring their own sort of baggage to the telling of the account. And David Haseman is quite a good example of that because he had a long career working in the merchant navy, in the shipping industry. And so there's a huge amount in his account of his mother's experiences, which is about ships, davits, how lifeboats are launched and so on. And although I think it's a very good reconstruction of his mother's story, it's almost, it seems to me, kind of overwritten. That whenever there's an opportunity to put in a sort of adjective, he never misses a chance to do that. And so even in this little account, we've got the sort of beautiful wood paneling, the plush carpeting, and so on. And I sort of found myself, when I was deciding how to use this account, taking out many of the adjectives. Frank Goldsmith's account, I'm not going to say anything about. Traveling third class with his parents, they lived in Struden, Kent, and they were going to Detroit. In this case, they did carry on, and Frank and his mother, Frank grew up in Detroit and stayed there. But I think it's a very interesting story from the perspective of a child and somebody travelling third class. Archibald Gracie, this is one of the artifacts from the wreck, this dollar bill, which I thought illustrated his story quite well. Again, Gracie's account is a famous one, travelling first class. He had been in Europe on holiday. He'd also had an operation, so he was recuperating from that. And he was travelling back on his own to the United States. And of my 12, he's the oldest, aged 53. One argument which interests me is why have I decided to use these quite familiar accounts? I try to balance familiar with unfamiliar ones. And I suppose my sort of defence is to say that I think these accounts are much richer than people realise. That often you get little sort of bits of them used in Titanic histories, but I think when you look at the full account, it is a very, very rich resource. And so one of the things that I've done, including with the Gracie account, is first of all to take out everything which is not obviously not eyewitness. Secondly, to add in a lot of other material about other passengers that he describes. And I suppose thirdly, and this is something I've really worked hard at, to try to make the accounts more consistent in style in the process of weaving them into my narrative. Again, Gracie's account's published fairly early, 1913. This is just a little extract from it, where Gracie writes, quote, "I now resume the narrative description of my miraculous escape, and it is with considerable diffidence that I do so. The personal equation monopolizes more attention than may be pleasing to my readers, who are not relatives or intimate friends." And I'm just putting this up to illustrate the point that Gracie's account is written in a style which I'm sure was already quite dated for 1913. I mean, it sort of seems more redolent of the perhaps the late 19th century or the early 19th century. There's a lot of religious imagery. Each of his chapters starts with a quotation from the Bible. And this presented me with some sort of challenges. The way he describes women, for example, he always refers to them as ladies. The account has almost got this sort of old-fashioned gallantry where he sort of offers his protection to unprotected ladies travelling singly, travelling alone. He always refers to them with that slightly dated form now where he'll use the husband's name. So he'll say, let's say the person's called Sarah Wilson, but he'll say Mrs. Henry Wilson. The way he describes people from perhaps southern European countries, using language that we would regard now as offensive or politically incorrect. So he actually does use the word dagos. What should I do with that? Should I keep it in? Should I take it out? Even the punctuation, actually. Very, very long sentences, lots of semicolons. Very different to the way that we would write today. I really like this photograph of Eva Hart on her arrival in New York, because I think it's clear to me that she's wearing clothes which are obviously not her own. I mean, like a lot of second and third class survivors, helped by people like the Salvation Army, the Red Cross, kitted out with new clothes, going to jumble sales and so on. Another migrant, the Hart family, lived in Seven Kings, east of London. They were going to Winnipeg in Canada. Again, this is another more recent account written up with the aid of a family friend, Ronald Deaney, and published in 1994. I will read this one out because I think it is interesting. So Eva writes, quote, Eva and Ron write, quote, "It was when we learnt of the possibility of travelling on the Titanic that a light dawned on my mother, and she said, 'I haven't known up till now why I do not want to go, but now I know.' I remember her answer as clearly as if I could hear her speaking the words now, 'Because this is the ship that they say is unsinkable,' she replied, 'and this is flying in the face of the Almighty. The ship will never reach the other side.'" And of course, there's an obvious myth here, which Rudy's referred to already, this question about the Titanic being unsinkable and so on. But I think the other issue that interests me is people retrospectively claiming to have predicted the disaster. And this is very common, as I'm sure you know, in survivor accounts. I think in the case of Eva's story, there is the possibility of checking this. And a letter that has survived is written by her mother on Sunday, the 14th of April. And I was very struck when I read her mother's letter that, you know, she sort of says, I felt a bit seasick. I haven't particularly enjoyed the voyage. I'm looking forward to getting to America. But she doesn't say anything in that letter about predicting a disaster or anxiety or anything. So, I mean, I personally I'm quite sceptical about many of these claims about people predicting the predicting the disaster. Ellen Hakkarainen, there are some surviving pictures of her, but not very good ones. This is another artifact, a plate from second class. Travelling from Finland to town Monessen, Pennsylvania. I found it very interesting when I did some research on the internet to find this little steel town south of Pittsburgh is one of the places where many people from Finland went to. Violet Jessop, you've already seen the picture of her, actually. Rudy put it up. It's quite a confusing photograph because, of course, she's in the uniform of the Red Cross, or what was known as voluntary aid detachments during the First World War. So I've replaced it with this image of these plates. But I'm really pleased I've included the story of Violet, because I really like this sort of upstairs, downstairs thread in my narrative. Violet Jessop's account is a really fascinating one, I think, edited by John Maxton Graham, published originally in 1997, because it presents rather different issues to the historian. I'll just read this out for people perhaps who are at the back, where they write, quote, "Anne Turnbull, my present companion, was the last person in the world I would accuse of that, and what they mean is smoking and drinking. She was a staid, placid, good soul, most restful, and of a certain dry wit, a wit that bore not a trace of malice. We went aboard, she and I, and plenty of time to go on a hunt of discovery. And this is, of course, just before the Titanic leaves Southampton, when the stewardesses are checking out their cabins. Viola Jessop's account was originally written up as a memoir in the 1930s, when she was still employed by the White Star Line. And what she does, because she wants... I mean, she feels a really genuine sense of exploitation, I think, as a stewardess. And she's actually quite rude about first-class passengers. But because she's still employed by the White Star Line, she gives many of these passengers pseudonyms. So she names many people, but we know from the passenger list that there was no one of that name on the Titanic. She doesn't name some real people, Thomas Andrews the designer, William O'Loughlin the surgeon, but it's a mix of real names and pseudonyms. I mean, I suppose it's a bit like the Julian Fellowes ITV series, which we could also discuss in more detail perhaps later. Anne Turnbull is interesting because it's clear that Anne Turnbull, although that is a pseudonym, it's clear that that was a real person, a stewardess called Elizabeth Leather, who is Violet Jessop's best friend on the Titanic. And the other fascinating thing that happened in the course of the research was that I discovered that I am also distantly related to Elizabeth Leather. So, wow. I mean, that came to me as a total surprise. And it was particularly satisfying, not just that I was related to Elizabeth Leather, but to be able to identify her as Anne Turnbull. Second Officer Herbert Lightoller, of course, the most senior officer to survive the Titanic, the hero of the 1958 film, played by Kenneth Moore. Lightoller's account, his memoir, published in 1935. Sometimes I find it quite helpful to think of these accounts in terms of three sort of groups. I think the first group are those that are published fairly shortly after the disaster, ones like Beasley's, Bride's, and so on. Secondly, the sort of category which were published in the sort of interwar period, Lightoller's falls into that category, Arthur Rostron's does, in some ways Violet Jessop's does as well. And then thirdly, the accounts which have been written up much more recently. The Goldsmith one, the Hakkarainen one, Edith Brown. I'm not going to read this out because it's quite long, but I mean, I'm going to make a fairly obvious point, but I think it's still a point worth making, which is that Lightoller's account has to be treated with quite a lot of caution, because, of course, at all points in that, he's concerned to protect his professional reputation. What sort of safety, we've talked about this already in the discussion, what did the Board of Trade do, what sort of safety drills had been carried out in Southampton, why did he allow lifeboats to go away half filled, many of the issues which of course he was questioned about at the American and British inquiries, when he maintained, I think it's fair to say, quite a robust defence of his actions. But clearly his memoir has to be treated with quite a lot of caution for that reason. Arthur Rostron's account, I'm not going to say anything about, but this is the famous photo, of course. I think Rudy used as a kind of inset this picture, the same picture of the so-called unsinkable Molly Brown. But in a way, I mean, I suppose this illustrates another point about my approach, which is, I've made the point already, I try to reconstruct this from the bottom up, but I also sort of consciously try to avoid some of the most famous crew members and passengers. So actually in the book, there's very little about Captain Smith, not a bit about Thomas Andrews, not very much, very little about the unsinkable Molly Brown, not much about Wallace Hartley, the band leader, Ismay, some of the other people who have been written about very much already. But Rostron is very much the kind of hero of my story. And then, Elizabeth Schutz, travelling first class, but she was only in first class because she was a governess. So she's quite an interesting, well, whether we call her a passenger or an employee of the family who are passengers. Quite a short account, but a very interesting one, I think. I mean, in some ways she crops up in some accounts, but she's not as well known as I think probably she should be. And then last but not least, what I think is probably the most interesting of my 12 accounts. This is the story of Hannah Tuma, my Lebanese family. quite a sort of happier story in some respects, because her husband, a man called Darwis, was already working in the United States. He and his brother had gone to this little town called, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I mean, I call it Dowagiac, which is in Michigan. They had been working there for some years earlier. And then it was actually Hannah's brother-in-law who sent the money for her fare without telling her husband. He also sent Hannah, as well as the fare, he sent a little piece of paper, and that all that that said on it was the words Dowagiac, Michigan. The family couldn't speak English. Hannah and the two children survived, and when they got to New York, it was only because they had this little piece of paper that said Dowagiac, Michigan, that they finally found a priest who could speak Arabic, and the family were reunited. I mean, I think it was just really the description of, she describes going by camel caravan from this little village of Tibnin to Beirut. Then they took a freighter to Marseille, trained to Cherbourg, and they joined the Titanic at Cherbourg. I think it's probably the conjunction of, you know, I was sort of reading about this camel caravan. I kind of imagined them going through the desert, and I thought, well, that's so amazing. They start off their journey like that, and of course they end up with the iceberg and the ice, and the conjunction of the sort of desert and the ice, I just find really fascinating. The family anglicised their name to Thomas, and this was written up by her grandson, Joseph L. Thomas, published in 2002. I suppose I'm just putting this up to illustrate this question of myth, because as in a lot of films, a lot of accounts, there is this story of the third class passengers being deliberately locked in. And despite looking at this in some detail, I haven't found any evidence to support that. I mean, you might want to take issue with me on that question. Seemed to me that they are clearly separated from the rest of the ship to comply with American immigration and health regulations, but I haven't found any evidence to support this point, which is often reproduced to suggest that the third class passengers were deliberately locked at the time of the sinking. And it interests me, I suppose, why do these myths persist? You know, why do people want to believe that it was the fastest ship, that it was unsinkable, and so forth? Apart from these 12 stories, there's various other themes that I try to cover. Things that interest me as a social historian. I became quite interested in individual artifacts, actually. The social history of the life jacket, you know, where did life jackets come from? Became quite interested in the history of these Engelhart collapsible boats as well. It was quite interesting actually writing the book, because when I sent the original proposal to the publisher, they said, oh yeah, we're pretty happy with this. They sent it out to three readers and they were broadly quite happy, but they said, well, we actually want more context. We want every chapter to have a theme. And I said, well, okay, I can do that. And I went away and took quite a lot of trouble to provide more contextual material so that every chapter had a theme as well as the stories of my passengers and crew. And then I sent in the final manuscript and they said, okay, we're pretty happy with this, but we think there's too much context. It gets in the way of the story. So right at the end, I end up taking a lot of this material out. So there is more context at the start, but then when quite exciting things are happening, like the sinking or the launching of the lifeboats, there's not much context there, and then there is more context at the end. Right, just two more minutes. It seems to me that Walter Lord's book, even though it was published over 50 years ago, is in many ways still the benchmark against which the success of any subsequent books have to be measured. It is a remarkable account, I think, republished by Penguin just about a week ago. I suppose the main development since is, of course, the discovery of the wreck by Robert Ballard, the new evidence about the ship actually breaking up, the artifacts that have been retrieved, and so on. But I suppose the final point I wanted to make, really, was the question in my mind, well, how does my book compare with Lord's? How does it contrast with Lord's? One of the arguments I would make, I think, is that clearly his book is very effective as a minute-by-minute depiction of events, but it seems to me that when he tries to explain the significance of the sinking, by comparison, those sections of his book are much weaker. So he makes a series of claims which I tend to be quite skeptical about, actually. And again, it might surprise you that historians are often more interested in continuities rather than changes. So I'm personally skeptical about many of the claims he makes about the Titanic sort of changing everything with regard to social class, this age of deference, he says something like, wealthy people were never as wealthy again, and so forth. So I do take issue with that at the end of the book. As I say, I've avoided many of the best-known characters deliberately, but I suppose one of the main claims I would make is that I've really tried hard to rebalance the narrative and to provide, hopefully, a more rounded narrative. Passengers and crew, women as well as men, children as well as adults, and particularly the experiences of migrants, people whose stories are often still forgotten, and who, I mean, this is very poignant, I think, when you look at the Encyclopedia Titanica website, people whose we know very little about. Often we only know their name, where they were from, what their ticket cost, those who sadly didn't survive, I mean. And then I suppose finally that my time frame is different to Lord's, in that what I'm trying to do is really to reconstruct this familiar story with a new approach, and by using what I call a life history approach. So I try to reconstruct these people's lives before 1912. Where were they from? What were their hopes? What were their dreams? What happened to them during the sinking? And really following them through right up until the end of their lives, until they died. So I think my 40 minutes are up. I'll stop there. Thank you.
This podcast was recorded as part of the Titanic 2012 conference, held on the 14th of April 2012 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.